Mark doesn't have a lot of questions. He's not good with that right now.
Real good.
Solid. Really solid.
Yeah.
Well, that was good of Wayne to let us go.
But it was, yeah.
I can't repeat all the good things that he's done one-on-one with some people that he just assumed probably not have people know about.
He helped people out of a lot of binds.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely.
He's very understanding. Well, those were challenging years.
Well, then as far as the 70s, we want to touch a little bit on when the collective bargaining came onto the scene. And
well, that my memory might fade me a little bit on the exact year, but that was in the late 80s, or maybe, no, I'm going to take that back, maybe 82, 83. Was the first years of collective bargaining for public employees in the state of Iowa. And I can still remember Wayne Drexler and I sitting in his office listening to the House and Senate debates down in Des Moines about the issue. Of course, at that time, the Iowa Association of School Boards and the Iowa Association of School Administrators for Superintendents were heavily involved in those discussions and keeping all board members and superintendents aware of what this all meant. And prior to that, our negotiations, if you may, with the different employee groups, the teachers, the bus drivers, all the hourly workers, if you may, were kind of meet and confer. The final, ultimate decision on any negotiations, wages or benefits paid to employees was really the board and the superintendent. The board obviously had to approve everything. But in most districts, and I think even at Western Dubuque, there was a concerted effort to meet the demands of the employees. Certainly back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, not all those demands could be met. The finances weren't there to do it, quite frankly. But when that passed, the Iowa legislature, boy, the flags really went up. There were multiple meetings that we attended that were put on by the Iowa Association of School Boards, where they brought in national speakers and said, okay, how are you going to create this first master contract? And there were school districts that were so opposed to it, they wouldn't even meet with the collective bargaining groups in the various school districts, just so opposed to it. School board members, individually and collectively in some regions of the state, were absolutely opposed to it and wouldn't accept it, that even that it was passed. There were efforts to repeal the law even in the following years. Long story short, the first year, obviously, the law passed. The only collective bargaining group that really surfaced at Western Dubuque were the teachers. They did organize, and we had to meet with them formally. For I think the first collective bargaining year that we had, I think we had something like probably 35 plus meetings with representatives of the teachers to come up with this first written master contract covering all the wages, benefits, and working conditions of the school district with the teachers. We spent probably 15 to 20 meetings just on procedure, how to do it. Arguing about who's going to be at the table, who's going to have the right to talk, how communication is going to be put out to the individuals and the people. It was just a lot of work. And, of course, both sides had attorneys, and we weren't like any other school district in Iowa. Probably 95%+ of the districts were all represented by attorneys, and on the other side, teachers were being represented by some very highly qualified, professionally trained people also. Everybody understood the importance of that first contract, yeah, and what it meant. And you just had to go through a lot. The way the law was written at that time, if you didn't have an agreement by in so many days, then you had to go through mediation, which we did. We had a federal mediator come in from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He was one of the top guys, and I think we had three different mediation sessions, and I can still remember the teachers coming in that one night because the mediator could keep you there 24 hours a day. And the teachers came in with their coolers and overnight and stuff and everything else, and we thought, oh my, you got to be kidding me. Meetings started, I think the first mediation started something like 7, 8 o'clock at night, and I think we went to 1:30 or 2 o'clock. And our representative, our attorney on the board, our chief spokesman, Lewis Himes, from attorney out of Dyersville, was not going to have any part of going all night. But we'd heard a lot of stories about a lot of districts where they're sitting there for 24 hours in mediation. And they did have, the mediator did have the power to compel that. Well, long story short, we got through mediation. And you had to go at that time to fact-finding, where both parties had to present proposals, the fact finder then would decide which proposal or what in between. He could say, okay, we'd like to give a 5% raise, teachers want 10%. Well, the fact finder supposedly would come in and make that decision, what was the most appropriate amount. He could go 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9, or 10. He could basically decide himself what he thought was appropriate. I always thought the term fact finder was wrong. You know, kind of gave the impression that he'd come in and find the facts. That was far from the case. You know, you present exhibits, and they present exhibits, and he makes a decision off the seat of his pants, quite frankly. I always thought what he thought was appropriate. It isn't like they came in and found the facts.
Really understood what was going on.
No. A lot of those people didn't have great financial background. You know, you present their information, they present their information, and he has to make some kind of good judgment on what it is. Well, you go through fact-finding, and that's a long, arduous thing that we had to go through. And I think we did reach a settlement after fact-finding. We didn't go on to binding arbitration like a lot of districts did the first year. But then an arbitrator would come in if you were to settle, and he could choose the district's final offer or the teacher's final offer or the fact-finder's final offer. He couldn't go in between. He had to choose one of the three. And that always really proved to be interesting because, you know, when you prepared yourself for those final offers, you know it's going to be one of the three.
Right.
And if you supported the fact finder on some things, then you better make sure that your final offer really clearly indicated that. So it was just a lot of meetings and work and time and careful study of the issues. And certainly compromises were made. There's no question in my mind that some of the articles that we have in the existing contract today, 30 years later, 40 years later, 30 years later, contain concessions that were made in that first contract. And once they're getting into the contract, you can't unilaterally change it. You got to have negotiations to change it, modify it, or get it out. Some of them might be controversial. For example, staff reduction based on seniority. Western Dubuque has that in their contract. Primarily seniority is the final basis for staff reduction.
Unfortunately, in a lot of cases.
Well, in some cases that's good, but now we're finding, we're seeing that more and more districts over the years have gone that route because it seems to be so arbitrary to do it on some other method,
right,
be it evaluations. The Iowa legislature and other entities have spent a lot of time trying to forcibly have school districts go through a very, very rigorous evaluation procedures for professional people, and not without controversy.
Right.
And you get done, look at all that, and you kind of wonder, well, is that the case? And it's really come down now, the involvement of the Department of Education and the Licensing Bureau, basically saying to building principals throughout the state of Iowa, once you've made that determination in the first few years of a teacher's employment, yeah, you know, once you issue them that professional license, and school districts have a voice in that, that's pretty tough to determine a teacher after that date.
Yep.
And if you're going to do it based on evaluations after that date, it's really, really got to be overwhelming.
Yeah.
And the issue comes back that, well, if you've made a professional judgment that this is a good teacher after 3 to 5 years of study, then for you to come back maybe in the 10th year and say, well, I don't think you're a very good teacher anymore because you're not teaching very well, that really has proven to be difficult to do.
Yeah.
So the whole collective bargaining thing was very troubling, and not only in Western Dubuque but all school districts in Iowa. It just really seems to be something that evolved, and I've made a lot of presentations to other professional groups in Iowa, superintendents and building principals and people wanting to be superintendents, about collective bargaining and how it works. And you really have to go in there and work with the people across the table. I've always said to the collective bargaining groups, whether it be the hourly unions or the teachers union, I never regret them asking for something. There's nothing wrong. You know, maybe their proposal is out in left field, but it also provides the district or the other side to listen to what concerns are about. And if you listen to them and accommodate them in some sense and try to listen rather than just close the door immediately, you can reach compromise. But you really got to know your audience, and you got to have that ability to come back and say to the governing board or the taxpayers in the district that these decisions were made for some rationale on it. But if you come right out on an initial offer, say, well, they just propose a lot of trash and a lot of money and we can't afford it, well, then you've already set the stage. You know, then it's going to be pretty tough to say, okay, their proposal was ridiculous. Then you kind of come back maybe 3-4 months later, and then you're asking them to accept some of that language as a final agreement. Yeah. And then you got a problem. You created yourself a problem from day one. That's why I never got too excited over the years about an initial proposal from one of the collective bargaining groups or even from regular groups that weren't organized for collective bargaining. I cannot get upset sitting at the table if somebody asked me for a $5 an hour pay increase for the whole group. I can probably ask why, talk to them a little bit about why we can't do it, but I'm not going to come out and blast them for it. I'm not going to tell them, well, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to go public with it to the press and say, well, they asked for a ridiculous proposal, so we're going to take some away or offer them zero. Try to soften that. You know, you got to get through it. Not easy to do sometimes.
Yeah.
I can remember many a time saying to our chief administrator over the years, be it Wayne Drexler or Harold Knutson back in those days, I said, you know, if you would have been in that room last night, gone through that negotiation session and listening to some of the things that were said and done, you'd probably be in jail this morning because you might have been swinging baseball bats. You've got to let some things go in one ear and out the other. If you get beat up about what's said at a collective bargaining table, then you shouldn't be at the table.
Yeah.
You just got to let that go through you. Things can get pretty personal. They can get pretty hot. They can get and you got to take a deep breath and step back and say, okay, we're going to get through this, and hopefully we can shake hands when this is all done. And that's not easy to do sometimes. You know, that's all about the personality of the people being involved. Some people can't do that. Some people, they get that confrontational issue, and it gets to be personal, and there's no way to help. I'm going to give into that. Well, you just can't get yourself in that position. Collective bargaining over the years has always been tough. It's one job that I won't miss doing.
Yeah.
I did it there for the last, 10, 15 years. I acted as the chief negotiator for the school district with all of our professional contracts with the teachers and then also with the hourly people. They organized into collective bargaining groups, and I won't miss doing that job. You have to go into those meetings very organized. You have to know where you're at. You got to understand where these things are at. If you're going to contribute to a meeting or get something done at a meeting, you've got to be organized and prepared when you go into it. If you go in unprepared, don't know what you're going to say, don't know how you're going to approach the topic, and you got to think it through. Where do I want to end up at on this? What can I say that's not going to be too upsetting to them? You really got to think it through. Sometimes you have to take a little break from a meeting to reestablish where we're going with this meeting. That's a lot of time involvement. That was one thing that I found, that if you're going to have successful relationships with your various employees in the district, you've got to put time into it.
Can't rush things.
No. Yeah. A lot of work in it. And understand what the language means. I can't remember how many times I had to explain what that language meant and what the intent of that language was to our administrators over the years and also to the school board. Yeah. Because the school board always had the final say on things. And school boards are great people, but they're lay people also. They really didn't understand, why you'd have to have language in this survey. They didn't understand the law in the sense that, okay, these are mandatory subjects of bargaining, and there's permissive subjects of bargaining, and which ones do we want to respond to and which ones we don't. There's just a lot involved. So you had to make sure, and you got new board members maybe every 3-4 years. You're kind of starting over with all those people. The experienced board members have gone through it, understand it, and maybe one board member.
Yeah.
It's a never-ending job. It really is.
Well, What are some of the other issues that you remember, like, you know, going into the 90s?
Well, I think the biggest challenge in our district, and I'll take it by decade, I was there in the 70s, and that the 70s, when I started in May of 1970, the school district was really growing in enrollment. You know, the district was organized in 1960. I wasn't there in the 60s, but in the 60s, it was just getting, the district was getting their feet on the ground. You know, just getting the curriculum established and getting things done and finances, and everything was new and we're growing, don't have buildings and stuff. 70s, all of a sudden, we really had a large enrollment, and we had a lot of shared time in the private schools in the 70s, and we didn't have buildings for it, and there was St. Joe's High School was open in Farley, and Akron High School in Cascade. Just a lot of changes going. We had portable classrooms all over the district.
We had a high school built for 250 students, you know. And
at one time in the 70s, early 80s, the district had 45 to 50 rented portables.
Wow.
Financially, we had to pay rent for those things. We didn't have the legal authority to purchase them. And we couldn't get bond issues passed. We tried three or four bond issues in the late 70s, early 80s, all failed. And it was just hard to get anything done. And then there was issues with shared time. The district was financially hurting. The finance formula wasn't the same as what it is today. It was just living. You see that homeowners talk about that, living from checkbook to checkbook. We literally lived from checkbook to checkbook in the 80s and 90s. Those were really tough financial times for the district. And yet we were faced with collective bargaining demands. And we needed, you got to have textbooks and supplies and materials. You got to operate.
Now, you know, not only that, but I remember the issues with the busing, trying to get more reimbursements from that, and that was never...
Well, I personally got involved with that with the Iowa Department. We went to the School Budget Review Committee how many times trying to get some help with our busing. It's a large, large rural school district, and we had to get the kids to school and just buying buses and operating them. That took a large chunk of our budget. But we knew, Wayne Drexler knew too, that without transportation in a large rural school district, you weren't going to have these kids come to these schools.
Yeah.
So we had to face that issue, and it was a real challenge in demand. And then, I think maybe in the late 70s, early 80s, in the 80s, they set up the Iowa legislature where we were going to provide buses or busing for the private schools. So then we had to, and the state paid to buy those buses, but didn't pay to replace them. In other words, buses you can get 7-8 years out, and we had to replace them. Well, where's the money for the replacement? That wasn't there. But even then, even with that non-public factor put aside, we had a hard time just maintaining our own bus fleet. You know, we were running buses. And 70s, 80s, and 90s were just financially really, really difficult times for the district. 2000s and current, like today, I think the district has gotten out of that. And we are in good financial shape. The busing issue, from what I can understand, finally might be resolved in this coming legislative session. There is some pretty good talk about pulling, setting that aside and reimbursing school districts for actual costs of busing. As I said to legislators in the past, even to the governor, that even if we could only get 40-50% of our reimbursement back, that would be better than nothing. I always argued the point that we were getting the same cost per pupil as a large school district like Urbandale, which didn't own a school bus. We have busing issues, public school busing issues, and our costs run $1 million to $2 million a year just for public schools. And we're, let's say, about the same size as school district. We got to spend $2 million for public school busing. Urbandale doesn't have to spend a dime. That's an inequity that needs to be corrected.
That's never happened.
And part of the issue is we've had legislation, you know, that was out there and people supported it, but we just haven't had the bandwagon of schools wanting to get behind it. There aren't that many large rural urban school districts in Iowa that want to get on that bandwagon. But now, as some of the districts, especially out in western Iowa, have started to reorganize like they did out here in eastern Iowa 40 years ago, there's more pressure to provide it. Because now all of a sudden they can say, gee, yeah, we got to buy some buses if we're going to reorganize. You know, we're going to be a lot bigger geographically with reorganization. We got to have some buses. They don't have the money to do it. So now I think there is an opening there maybe to get some funding for that busing for public school students.
Yeah.
The non-public busing issue, I think, has been a little bit overblown. We've been shorted on our reimbursement over the years, but they've done a decent job of reimbursing school districts for non-public reimbursements. Not 100%. But I wish we had that same type of funding for the public schools. And that hasn't happened. But the Urban Education Network in Iowa, representing big city schools in Iowa, have not been supportive of that. They would like to see that that money, if it's available, be used for other issues that support urban schools. So there had to be a compromise. I always said that if the rural school districts in Iowa that have these busing costs want to get this through the Iowa legislature and get the governor to support it, there's going to have to be something that's going to help the urban schools also with some of their unique problems. That's been the argument. Urban schools have some unique problems maybe with the minorities and things like that in their city schools.
Yep.
And if that can be addressed on the same token as the rural school busing issue, then I think that might happen. And it looks like that might just happen here in the near future. But a lot of funding issues over the years, and it's just been an ongoing battle. I mean, you really have to keep on top of it. We've been fortunate over the years to have understanding school administrators and school boards that have allowed us to limp along when we really had to limp along. Like I say, we didn't
do with less because
there was not a lot of dynamics done in the 80s and 90s with facilities and operational costs. We had large class sizes. You know, I can still remember back in the 80s and 90s, class sizes of upper 20s and low 30s were acceptable. Not today. But we do have better funding today.
Yeah.
I do think the Iowa funding formula needs to be continually modified. It's one of the better ones in the nation. But I've always said, we get, let's just say, for example, $6,000 per pupil. We get $6,000 for a kindergarten kid, and we get $6,000 for a high school student. To me, that's not equitable. It costs more to operate for a high school student.
Right.
And in this district, we have two high schools. Most school districts our size, we're the only school district in the state of Iowa operating two high schools.
Right.
Then you put a couple of the transportation charges along with that. You know, you're running two extracurricular programs. It costs a lot of money. I'm absolutely convinced our cost to operate high school, getting high school kids an education, is a lot more expensive than a kindergarten or first grade teacher or program.
Sure.
But I'd like to see the formula modified so that maybe kids K through 6 would get a certain funding level per pupil. Kids from 6 through 8, for example, middle school would get another level, and then high school maybe a higher amount, actually. And then even on the high school level, I think the state of Oklahoma does that a little bit. On the high school level, they actually break the high school down into major academic areas. If you've got so many kids enrolled in an industrial vocational programs where it involves buying a lot of equipment and maintaining that equipment, you'll get more money for those kids that enrolled in that course than those that are maybe just in, let's just say, the pure classroom areas of English and math. Obviously, having an English and math program is a lot less expensive than having a foreign language than, let's say, industrial arts or electronics or vocational ag.
Right.
And some states have segregated out the high school funding that way. Iowa
like that
needs to look that way.
For people to understand that
well,
makes sense.
It always costs money.
Yeah.
And the arguments are going to be that, well, who's going to come up with that additional funding? Obviously, if you're going, you can't just reallocate the resources. All of a sudden, say, okay, take something away from the elementaries and give it to the high schools or middle schools or even within the high schools. That won't happen. But there's little doubt in my mind that high schools cost more. And when we have two high schools to run, that puts an additional burden on Western Dubuque. I've had so many board members after they've been on the board for 3-4 years and maybe gone to a few conferences saying, how did you guys do it over the years? All those rented portables, operating 2 high schools, all the transportation costs, how did you manage to make it? It wasn't easy. It's just a real challenge. It really was. There just wasn't money to go around, yet we had to do it. There's just no way around it. I'd like to see the funding formulas change, though, so that there would be equitable funding. So that when I always looked at the percentage of students that we had in high school, including West Dubuque High School and Cascade High School, to our total enrollment, versus what the state average was for that. We were always running 4 or 5% higher than the traditional K-12 or pre-K-12 school. Yeah. You know, in the perfect world, you'd have, let's just say, small numbers, you'd have 25 in each grade. Well, all of a sudden, when we get to the high school, because we're running 2 high schools, we got more than 25 in grades 9 through 12. A lot more. Yeah. Percentage-wise, you know, in four grades out of 12 should be pretty equal. Has never been the case at Western Dubuque. Yeah. And so we don't get as much money, and yet we got to run 2 high schools. Those were real challenging problems, making things meet in the 80s and 90s. And, of course, there were some people who said we should consolidate the 2 high schools into one. That would never happen in this district. It would be a mistake. It really would be. That's too far.
Well, I said that might have been seriously considered this one after closed, I guess.
But
back at that time, you never got support for.
Well, there was discussion. You know, I can't get into all the details, and I wasn't privy to all the details either. But obviously, when Cascade a decision was made down there at Cascade to close, the building was offered for sale to Western Big Schools. I think we bought that for, I'm not sure, I think it was $1.1 million or something, but I took a bond issue. Had the bond issue failed, but it obviously had overwhelming support, especially from the Cascade area.
Yeah.
Had that failed, there might have been some talk about doing something centrally, but you know, that just never got off the band. I think there were some other political issues. I think if it would have failed, I think it would have been a pretty good chance that the Cascade area would have looked at consolidating and forming their own school district. Whether that would have been a good decision or bad decision, who knows? But I don't.
Wayne talked about going to some meetings in the '60s, mid '60s, at Dyersville, where they were seriously considering closing. Well, it was Xavier at that time.
Well,
and he said, "Well, the Archbishop put a kibosh on that, I guess."
At one time, when Akron closed. There was a lot of talk at that time about Beckman even closing.
Yeah.
Beckman had already been built. And they were having financial problems too. Everybody was having financial problems back in those days. And it was 76, I think, when Akron closed. And Beckman was for sale too, or we were going to close. And it got real serious over in Dyersville. Some citizens finally, because the church kind of took hands off, they weren't opposed to it. And some citizens finally got together in Dyersville, supporters of the private school system, and organized a major fundraiser to keep the school open. And that was big money back then. I think they were looking to raise $1 million or $2 million into a foundation to keep it open. And they did. They got the job done. Cascade went through the same thing, had a big foundation started to keep Cascade open, Akron. And the primary investor of that was going to make the big donations, financially something went wrong there, and his whole donation fell through. And all of a sudden, that wasn't an option for Cascade Akron.
Yeah.
So then the building did get sold to Western Dubuque, subject to voters approving it, buying it. But same thing could have happened at Dyersville. That was in, like I say, that was in 76, 77. But there the people did organize and had a fundraiser to keep the building open. And, even then, in the late 80s, when we had three or four bond issues fail, because it was kind of setting to our school district that we had all these portable classrooms, shared time all over the place, and no decent classroom. Portables all over the place. Couldn't get anything passed. There was a lot of talk about disillusionment of the school district. The district said dissolve. Superintendent Drexler at the time was very public about it. He said, he thinks the district should dissolve. As far as he's concerned, if we can't afford to have buildings, then we should dissolve the district. That was not popular, especially with the supporters of public education. The communities of Cascade, Epworth, Farley, they didn't like to hear that talk. His point, however, is if we can't afford facilities, we can't get bond issues passed, then we should dissolve. And Wayne was doing that politically also to get the people to understand that you better support something or we're going to just have to end these schools. He had discussions, informal, with Dubuque Schools, Maquoketa Valley, about Dubuque taking over the high school at Epworth, and Piasta there was basically non-existent as far as a public school. Taking over the Epworth program, Farley would have probably gone to Dubuque Schools also. Dubuque was interested. Dyersville would have probably been part of the Maquoketa Valley District. Cascade would have probably had to reorganize to go with Monticello. Those things were talked about very seriously. And that was a real troubling time back in the late 80s, early 90s. Really troubling time.
I remember when that, forget which one that was, late 80s, that bond issue. I don't remember. How close to that? Do you remember how close that came to passing? I don't recall.
Well, the last one that failed, I think, was for 8.6. It seemed like a lot of money at the time. 8.6 or $8.2 million.
Yeah.
And that would have put an auditorium at Cascade High School, West Dubuque High School, and a new gym at West Dubuque High School, classrooms, an auditorium and classrooms in Farley here, and also a new K-8 in Dyersville. All that could have been done for $8.2 million back I think that was 91, yeah, when that was defeated. And that basically what we did in the 90s with all these, now repeated that at a cost of probably $35 million. But we could did all that 20 years ago, earlier, 15 yeah, years earlier for 8.6 and more. Would have more facilities, more building than what we did now, but that's another whole story.
Yep.
But I can't recall. I had a spreadsheet showing what those percentages were on each one of those bond issues that needed approval, and I think we only got 43 or 44% approval on the last one, and it needed 60%. And that was after a major effort.
Not even close.
It was really disappointing. We just couldn't get it through, and it was very frustrating for Superintendent Drexler at the time.
Is that when he kind of decided, well, I've had enough?
Wayne was kind of, but then the district came back with a bond issue, you know, that did pass, the last one, a little less money. We had no school in Dyersville, took Dyersville off. That seemed to be the hot spot. There were people in the northern part of the district, and even in Farley, Epworth, and Cascade, that did not want a school in Dyersville. They did not want that building built. And obviously there was some opposition in Dyersville too, but it was really funny. I remember on that one that failed, I think 54 or 55% of the people in the precincts in Dyersville supported that bond issue, but the rest of the district voted it down. We got basically no votes out of all the north precincts. I think the only precinct in the rest of the district that supported that bond issue was Farley or Epworth. Cascade was against it. So at that time, the board president was Howard Steffen, and Dave Bell was representing Dyersville, and he was against changing the bond issue. He wanted that school in Dyersville, too. But long story short, the next bond issue took Dyersville off, and it took the auditoriums off and a few things like that. And got it down to price, and then it passed. And then we didn't really do anything more till 2001. But that did get rid of the portable classrooms, and we passed another bond issue to get Epworth Elementary built as it exists. But
thank goodness for the local option sales tax.
Yeah, and you know, the first vote for that was a county vote for Dubuque County, and that failed.
Right.
And then the second time around, it did pass. And that was really, really a close vote. I think the second passage on that was about 51%.
Yeah.
And from a precinct standpoint, the Western Dubuque precincts did not support it.
Yeah.
But
that.
It was carried by Dubuque.
Yep, thank goodness.
Yep, it really was. And then we were able to do some things immediately. And we immediately, I think within, vote on it was in January of 2001. And we were ready to issue bonds to get started ready in February and March. Our board made a good decision. There was some discussion thinking that we should wait and accumulate funds under the sales tax provisions and then build them. That would have meant putting it down 3-4 more years. But I'll be very frank on this discussion. I advised the board that we should get going on this right now. Interest rates were low. Let's get something done now, because there was a provision of the law that allowed for a recall. And there was obviously strong opposition against the county sales tax in Dubuque County. And if they got a petition up, and they could do it in three ways, they could present this petition to the local school boards. That would have been Dubuque and Western Dubuque school boards. Or they could present it to the county board of supervisors. That was a third way to present that petition. I think there was a fourth way, too. But those were the three major areas. If they presented a petition with enough signatures on it, then there could be a recall vote. But it had to be done within 12 months of that date of approval. Yeah. And I was concerned that that was going to happen. So I did, quite frankly, advise at that time Harold Knutson and the school board that I think we need to get this debt bonded, because it couldn't have a recall if it was bonded debt against that. So we had the public hearings to issue the bonds and the like, and a month after we had the board approve the resolution to issue the debt, then we had to have another meeting to approve the bids for the sale of the bonds. But that's after the authorization had been approved. And of course, that could have been appealed. Well, when we got to the meeting to approve the sale of the bonds, then there was a formal challenge made by individuals in the district that didn't want to see it happen. But they should have did it a month earlier. They did it a month too late.
Hearings were at the
Piazza. Yeah, but
I remember that.
Then what happened is they appealed that to the Dubuque County Attorney because they presented. He should have presented that petition a month earlier at the resolution approving the sale of the bonds, not approving the sale. Because the following meeting, okay, the bonds are going to be sold. Now you approve who's going to get the bid. And they just missed a time frame. And the county attorney kind of made the comment in his legal opinion to the supervisors, because they petitioned the supervisors on it, that apparently the law was written to allow this recall election, but and he kind of hinted at it at the time, the district appears to have superseded that by issuing the bonds already, which we did. Did it intentionally.
Yep. Cool.
To cut that off. Because there was a little doubt in my mind that that was going to happen. And we did get the bonds. We had debt issued against revenue already. So once debt was issued, the way the law issued, you know, if you were buying one of those bonds, the last thing you want is all of a sudden, who's going to pay me? So the law protected you as a buyer, saying, okay, you can't have a recall election if debt has been issued against it. And that's what we did. Okay. Though if had that not happened, I think that the thing would have been recalled, and we probably would have been out without funding for 4 or 5 years, because then later the legislature made that statewide.
Okay.
I think in 2009 or 2010, then the local elections all ended, and it was basically statewide. But I think we would have probably been out without sales tax funding in Iowa, in Dubuque County, for most of that first decade.
For the decade.
Yeah, and when I look at that, I look back on that, and I keep thinking, now, had we not issued that debt so quick in 2001, where would we be at today? Yeah. A lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah. Wow.
What that one action, that very quick action of the board and this district, what we did back in...
That happened...
2001. 2 months after the sales tax. But we voted on it, I think it was January 2001. And I think we approved the resolution for the sale of the bonds in March. And then we had to take bids on those bonds. And then I think at the April meeting, the board had to approve the bids. And that's when the petition was presented he wanted to appeal the public hearing on the sale. But the public hearing was a month earlier.
Yeah.
So he missed that. So then the opposition there, they had a legal challenge, and they appealed it to the Iowa Appeals Board. So we had a representative from the Secretary of State's office, the Department of Management, and the Department of Revenue. Those three people, they were very formal. It was a very formal hearing. They were here in Piasta.
I sat there.
They had to make the ultimate decision on it. And it was a legal issue. There was a lot of petition, a lot of things said at that meeting and everything else. They had attorneys. We had an attorney. They had a very, very solid case. But the ultimate question on all that was, did they have jurisdiction? They did. And if you read their 50-page opinion, that's what it comes down to. They really didn't issue an opinion. They didn't have jurisdiction. The jurisdiction ended when the board issued those bonds, approved the public hearing. They were caught in the same limbo, if you may, as what the county attorney was. They didn't have authority. They couldn't change that. Bonds had been issued.
But they still had to have the hearings.
Had to have the hearings. Yeah. They had to come make a decision. Well, their decision by law was that they couldn't do it. They weren't jurisdictional anymore.
Yeah.
But a lot of people didn't see that. I mean, there was a lot of exhibits presented, a lot of people talking about we had this and that. All that was fluff. The bottom line was, did they have jurisdiction to make the decision? They didn't. And, you know, it's like I say, I remember getting that opinion or getting that back, and that was our argument behind the scenes. Wasn't a lot said about it, but I remember Mike Schubot was our attorney at the time. Worked with Mike very closely on that whole thing. He agreed with me because I argued from day one that if we get these bonds issued, I don't see how they can challenge us. And Mike was a very sharp attorney, and I think now he's a district court judge. Yeah. And we talked a lot about it, and he did a lot of research on it, and very candidly made sure that our final arguments in the briefs that were filed, you know, contained a lot of case law on why they were not jurisdictional on this issue. And certainly, you have to go through all this other crap, you know, in case the state board, those three judges, if you may. If they make a decision that they are jurisdictional, then you want to fall back on what your case is for passing them. Do we need a school in Dars or in Piast, all that stuff? Well, we didn't have to worry about that, but you still have to present that part of the case in case they. Yeah. If that doesn't happen. A lot of people don't understand what all happened there. There were just so many things behind the scenes that get lost in the detail, and, well, we won. That's all they know.
Yeah.
I still think one of the most critical decisions this district made back in for looking at all of our buildings, you asked, okay, the biggest thing was the building programs that we did in from 2001 through 2013. Just great. It's been great for the school district, and I think it's also helped with the non-publics in our district. I think the non-publics have benefited from the communities of Piast and Farley and Epworth and Darzo included and Cascade to a certain extent. Those communities have grown because of us having a decent educational program and facilities. The non-public schools will continue to have good programs if there's people here. And one way to get people into your community is have good schools. And I think in that decade from 2000 now through 2014, we really improved the schools at Western View in almost every town. That helps with enrollment and census and businesses moving in, and the private schools benefit from that. More power to them.
What's happening at Piasta?
More power to them.
Wow.
But I still think that all comes down to what this school district did back in March, I think, of March or April of 2001.
Yeah.
That one decision to issue those bonds, because there's no doubt in my mind that if they would have had a recall election, they would have won the recall. It was that close.
Wow.
And then we would have sat there probably. We would certainly would have tried to get it through again, but probably would have had to vote on it probably a year or two later.
Yeah.
Probably would have got defeated. I'm not sure we would have got that local option tax through on another vote.
Yep, it was. But still would have included Dubuque, right?
So it was a countywide vote.
Yes.
And after the fact, Dubuque was, the opposition was not that organized in Dubuque. And I guarantee on the recall vote, it would have been organized.
Yeah.
The private schools viewed that as a major threat to their existence. But I think they recognized that out here in the Western Dubuque area. I don't agree with their argument on it, that it was a threat. I really don't. I think it helps them in the long run. But I think there would have been a lot more organized opposition within the city of Dubuque to do that. We were fortunate to get the Dubuque Chamber of Commerce to support it. And that was a very split vote. There were some very upset organizations and businesses in Dubuque, corporations, that were not happy. It wasn't a unanimous vote to support the passage of the countywide sales tax for schools. I don't think we would have had that support on a recall.
Yeah.
Because some of the chamber officers, they had a vote on it in there, but it wasn't unanimous. It was very, very close. And I think we would have lost their support. We had the support of the Dubuque City Council. I'm not sure that would have stayed in place.
Yeah.
And without that, and even then, Dubuque precincts only had 51 or 52%. 51, I think.
Well, and, so then you would have had to wait until it was made into a statewide
system. Yeah, which would have been 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have what we had. We wouldn't have got bond issues passed.
No.
When I think back, I kind of wonder what the picture of the public and non-public would have been right now had not been for that one event in 2001.
Amazing.
And we had board members back in 2001 that did not want to issue those bonds. They told members of the public when we were trying to get the thing passed, well, they don't have to worry about it. We won't be building any buildings until we got enough money saved. And they kind of had, they had to face, they probably should not have said that, but they did. And so they were kind of in a little bit of a
back up.
What do I do now? I told so-and-so we wouldn't be building, doing anything. And all of a sudden here 2 months later, we're issuing bonds. And it was a unanimous decision by the board, but it was
after some reconsideration.
It took a lot of discussion and talk. And there were a lot of people who felt, well, we weren't ready for it yet. Well, to me, we had to move. If we would have waited, I think even to consider selling bonds in June or later, I think there would have been a recall election filed. They wouldn't have filed with Western Dubuque or Dubuque. It was going to be filed, which it was, with the County Board of Supervisors. And I can't recall, but I don't think we had the County Board of Supervisors on vote as a political group. They wouldn't take a position on it, on support of the countywide sales tax. So they were willing. I remember at that time, the county attorney, he was very willing to take that issue up. They accepted the petition and were going to act on it, but they asked for advice from the county attorney, who wrote that. I got that opinion someplace, where he candidly kind of said, well, looks like West Dubuque, you didn't use the word snuck or sneak, but West Dubuque somehow, through a loophole in the law, managed to get these bonds sold, which was going to prevent a recall. And the county attorney was facetiously kind of saying, I'm not sure that was the intent of the law, to allow one of the taxing jurisdictions to enter into bond debt in the first year. But it clearly said that you couldn't do it. You had to do it in the first year unless one of the things, one of the jurisdictions issued into bond. Probably one of the more troubling things that I had at that time. And I, quite frankly, pushed our board really, really hard to do that. But what was really troubling, I was also trying to get the Dubuque schools to do the same thing. explaining to them, you guys need to issue, even if you only issue $1 million. It didn't have to be a $20 million project. Issue $1 million of bond against revenue, the sales tax revenue, to fix your roofs or something.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do it. I don't know if that was a communication problem with district administration and the board, or they just didn't understand the legal of it, or didn't have their get legal advice on it.
Who was the business manager then?
Joe Link. And I just don't understand that they had money, the big schools, so in their construction funds anyway. But I don't think they realized the importance of trying to get this thing passed.
Yeah.
And get bonds issued. But it didn't matter, just if one of the schools did it. And we took that big leap. I talked hours and hours about some of those things, but I tell you, that's been so gratifying over the last... of my career, the last 12 years, to see these
take
buildings built.
Take a look at those facilities.
Yep.
Wow.
And we finally got some money in our schools, even in the general fund, so we could start doing things. I've always tried to get technology into our programs. I can still remember this pushing in the hot lunch program that we do away with paper tickets in the lunch line. And I think I had so many parents call me up and mad as hell because they couldn't let their kid go through. They had to buy this electronic thing, and getting that pushed through was just I can still remember after the first year, then I had some, you know, the food service people and even parents and principals included say, well, we're glad we got rid of that. We weren't supportive of it, but we can see the benefits of it now. And I've always said, even down, I never got this task done, but I always felt I didn't like cash in buildings. There's nothing but problems. I've always wished that even in the activity funds of the district, and you see school districts doing that now, that we would get cash out of the concession stands, we'd get them out of the gates and everything else. And you can do
that. Stuff down time after time after
count
time.
Money. I just always was afraid. We had a great, wonderful events in the activity areas, whether it be the show choir events or whatever, just so much cash. And I always said to myself, that's just a mistake having all this cash around. We need to go to electronic cards. And in the last 5 years, the technology for that is so evolved that now it should be a given. But I wasn't going to try to push that agenda any harder than what I did over the last 2 years. I certainly made people aware of the fact that we could do this, but I said, I'm not going to go out there and do it unless you people support it and want to do it.
Yeah.
And some things scare people, that all of a sudden maybe they, what are you going to do with this parent that comes in from out of town and they don't have this card? I said, everybody's got a card anymore.
Yeah.
And if they came to a Western Dubuque event, you might lose a little money because they got mad and walked home, went back in their car, couldn't get in, or maybe you have to send it. You find accommodations to get it through the first time.
Yeah.
But the idea of paying for, and then you have control of inventory. You go to the concession stand, be on the football field or in the auditorium area there. You give them a debit card.
Sure.
Just like you do at McDonald's now. And you don't handle the cash. And that way you got all your inventory. You got a computerized inventory of how much pop you sold, how many sandwiches you sold, how many potato chips, popcorn. And you know, you got all those. You can do something with that data. And you don't have people running to the bank at midnight or locking the cash in the safe. And then the cash receipts aren't coming up with the disbursements. And you get rid of all those troubles.
We could never reconcile the tickets to the gate receipts.
Yeah. But you can do away with all that. Now, last year I seen there's a few school districts in Iowa that are large districts that are going down that road, and for good reason. It's just because I always read with interest every year the State of Iowa Auditor's Report on state audits for schools. And every year there's five or six school districts that just have horrible issues with loss of funds due to employee theft or booster club theft and the like. And the state auditor's office doesn't have the authority to mandate these things, but they make sure that they want the public to know that these are issues that are out there. There isn't a school district around that hasn't had serious problems with that.
Yeah.
Major problems. And it continues to occur. And a good remedy for it, there's always somebody else out there that can outsmart the system, but a good remedy for it is to get things done electronically.
Yeah.
Just you have to do that. I, I remember years ago when I first started, all the cash that came into our office from these schools at the beginning of the year, textbooks.
Fundraising.
Yeah, textbooks.
You're selling pizza. You're selling whatever.
And making deposits. You know, now with smartphones and the like, you give them your smartphone code and you're done. But I never got that job done, but I do think I always told my successor, Mark Frazier, that, well, that's a challenge. You can undertake that one now, the electronic, get that all done.
Well, Dave, you've had quite a run. Have you ever thought about, like, now you're retired, but you could consult to districts and whatever?
I've had calls and invites to do that. I have, but I've declined them.
Okay.
Now, I've made a decision that I'm not going to go. I'm 66. I'm not going to go down that road.